Blog Talk Radio.
Archangels, ghosts, and Bigfoot. Oh my! It's just another night for Supernatural Girls. Real stories, real answers to life's biggest supernatural mysteries. And now for another exciting interview with paranormal experts from this world and others. Psychic medium Helene Olson and paranormal researcher Patricia Baker. Here are Supernatural Girls.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Supernatural Girls. Today is Saturday, July 20th, 2013, and it is a beautiful evening in New England. But we'd like you all to call in at 646-478-0828 so that you can talk to our guest, Guido Masse. And I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Patricia.
I think you are. It sounds right to me.
Okay.
We're going to find out when we bring him on shortly.
yeah, that's true. But he wrote a great book called The Wild Medicine Solution, and you can, I think, find that on Amazon, perhaps his website as well. We'll have to talk to him about that. But, I think it's going to be a fascinating show because I love talking about herbs and their medicinal properties and what they can do for us. That's outside of Big Pharma, Patricia, because
yes.
It gets so overwhelming after a while.
Well, and there's so many side effects with medications.
It.
You know, mm-hmm. There's just too many side effects. There's always a huge price to pay when you, besides just paying the money, when you use something from the pharmacy. So it's, you know, we're not against medication, you and I, but
no.
When you have to take it for a long period of time, there's often very many side effects. And so it's going to be great to talk to Guido because he is a clinical herbalist, an herbal educator, and a garden steward. And he's also the co-founder and co-director of the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism. And he's also a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild and the American Botanical Council. So he's quite the expert. He's also a world traveler. So he's been everywhere, and he's going to talk to us about herbs, not just here, but everywhere. So it's going to be a fascinating show.
It really is, and one aspect of him that I noticed that was just really resonated with me was the idea that just being around plants can help you.
I thought that was amazing, too. That's wonderful.
And I really thought that that was an idea that people are definitely picking up. I mean, there are community gardens everywhere around the country that sort of spread quite rapidly, and it's still going. But beyond that, it's like, well, even if you don't use them for medicine or don't know anything about it, it's so easy to just work with plants.
Yes.
And to be in their vibration.
Yes.
Very healing.
Yeah, and I want to hear more about this because he has a lot to say about our being connected or disconnected from the plant world and how that affects our health in general. So there's a lot to be said tonight about our health and plants and the entire plant kingdom. So it's going to be great.
So, you know, if people want to hear more about our guests, because we do have such fascinating guests, they should go on over to supernaturalgirls.com, that's girls with a Z, and sign up for the newsletter, which they'll receive once a week. And you do such an amazing job with that newsletter. There's lots of paranormal information in there, as well as the opportunity to win a free gift. And we will be giving away some books and so forth in the near future. And the only way you can enter is signing up for our free newsletter. So
that's right.
I should go on over and do that. So, Patricia, you have paranormal news tonight?
I have a couple of very interesting stories. Now, the first one, you know, we had some great Bigfoot guests on. We had oh my goodness, they had tracked Bigfoot out in the Pacific Northwest, and we played the calls, the different sounds, and we had the cryptolinguist from the Navy talking about the Bigfoot language. So we've had some really terrific shows about Bigfoot. And
they're all
today,
in the free archives, right, Patricia?
They can still listen to those, yes, in the free archives on supernaturalgirls.com. And today there was something posted that happened apparently just recently in Georgia, where they have somebody with a video camera, a man, and you hear him yell, "Get inside, get back inside," to whomever he's with. And
yeah.
then he's, because he has spotted a Bigfoot that appears in his lens, and then he starts running after it. Like, I can't believe that he would run after it. I would be a little intimidated, I think, but he took after
the Bigfoot.
I
wouldn't make it to any running stage. I think I would just automatically pass out.
You might. Yeah, I think a lot of people might. So,
yeah.
So anyways, this guy takes off to the woods with his camera, which is unfortunately a little bit like the Blair Witch Project kind of filming.
Oh, boy.
And but he did catch a few scenes of what appears to be Bigfoot, and Bigfoot growled at him a couple of times. So I posted this video on the Supernatural Girls Facebook page, so you can all go there and take a look at it. I'd love to hear your thoughts from our audience.
And like
tonight.
Our page while you're there looking at
Yeah,
Facebook.
Give us a like. Yeah,
yeah,
definitely give us a like. And let us know what you think about this video. Do you think it's real or not? So it's very interesting. And then the second piece of paranormal news I have tonight is a little scary, but kind of interesting too. And it's about the fact that there's been some new studies on how magnetism can actually alter decision-making and morality. So there's this article about this. It's been posted in a few places. Apparently, there's this study from MIT, which opens up a whole new world of questions for us. But basically,
but where is the magnetism coming from? CAT scan machines or magnetic bracelets?
They actually did this, yeah, really, we got to worry about everything. But what they're talking about is they placed a volunteer, they're claiming it's a volunteer, in an electromagnetic field, and this Dr. Ross Ady of the University of California made this discovery. He was using specific radio waves, and he was able to influence his subject's brainwaves. Now, another scientist, Alan Frey, took this research a step further. Frey found he could remotely induce sleep in his subjects by subjecting them to electromagnetic waves. He also learned he could produce acoustic noises, booming, buzzing, and hissing, directly inside the volunteer's head. So developing on Frey's earlier work, Joseph Sharp, a doctor at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, was able to transmit spoken words via pulsed microwaves. So sitting inside an electromagnetic field, Sharp clearly heard and understood words transmitted to him by a colleague. So this is an enormous breakthrough in terms of understanding how things can be transmitted, but it is also a little concerning in how these types of things could be misused.
Well, it's kind of interesting to me because I didn't read the articles that you did, but, you know, they've always known that high-tension wires affect people's health if you live near them or
yes.
under them. But beyond that, you know, the conspiracy theorists, the people who really pay attention to all layers of misdeeds in the government and so forth, claim that the government has been shooting these things at people for years.
Yes. Yes, we've heard stories about that, even from our friend Dr. Puharich, also talked about
mm-hmm.
that at length.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's been some, you know, some stories that have circulated, some concerns. But also, at the same time, what's so fascinating is, does that also explain telepathy? That people who are able to communicate through these electromagnetic waves, is that how they're doing it? I mean, this might be a key to how psychics can hear and understand other people's thoughts and feelings through this electromagnetic field. So it's quite possible that this holds a key for people like you and me who are highly intuitive and pick up on other realities and other people and things that have passed to other dimensions. So there might be something to all of this that also answers
the question. So, Patricia,
are
you saying there's a hole in our head somewhere?
Well, let's not ask our husbands, because they're going to say yes.
I've always thought that to be truly psychic to hear that exact information. I'm not talking about random noise, but, you know, exact information. There's got to be some kind of little wiring glitch.
A glitch or some type
a
of
difference.
A
difference.
Right.
Won't call it
or
a glitch.
Or the ability to
difference.
Ride the waves. You know, an ability
mm-hmm.
to be so flexible with your own electromagnetic field and other people's that you can ride those frequencies and
mm-hmm.
really get through to that other person or entity or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've even had animal psychics on the show, you know, who can communicate with dogs and cats and other animals. And so it also may provide an explanation of how these people are able to do this.
Well, it's really interesting because it actually happened to me today.
What happened?
I was intensely thinking about someone that I really wanted to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And she called.
Perfect. How perfect is that? And that
weeks.
Happens.
I
see,
said, oh,
and that doesn't happen.
But
that's
she's
great.
Psychic, too. So that's, you know, kind of interesting. She just called before the show, but I sent
wonderful.
A message probably around, I don't know, early this morning. I was thinking about her intensely, and then she called. And she says, I don't know why I picked up the phone and called you. But she's, you know, she's a psychic as well. But that's kind of interesting because that's happened to me multitudes of times over the years. And I'm sure it's happened to you, too. You know, you put the thought out there, and the person who's also intuitive actually picks up on it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, and it's wonderful, you know, to, again, to see science appears to be catching up with some of what people are experiencing, and it's fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating to me that this person, this scientist, was actually able to hear specific words. That in and of itself is, again, it's amazing. This is not just an ambiguous, oh, I think you're thinking this. It was actual words that were transmitted. It's very specific.
It's almost as shocking as Edison picking up the phone and hearing the words, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It truly is. That's a good analogy. I like that. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, it immediately came into my head. It's just another level.
Yes. That's right. That's right. So those are my two pieces of paranormal news tonight. But everybody, take a look at our Facebook page, Supernatural Girls, on Facebook, and take a look at that footage when you get a chance. And we'd love to see your comments on that.
That'll be great to see what people's vote is on that video.
Yeah, I love it when people weigh in. People always have wonderful comments, and they're very, you know, they're very astute and critical people who really take a look at this, and I want to know what they think. So let us all know.
That's great, Patricia. Should we welcome Guido?
Yes, let's bring Guido on.
Okay.
Let's find out about everything he has to say about plants.
And to everyone who's listening now, you can call in your question to Guido at 646-478-0828. And welcome, Guido. You're live on the air with Supernatural Girls. How are you tonight?
I'm great. Hey, Helene. Hey, Patricia. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for joining us, Guido.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit, I mean, your background is just absolutely fascinating. What led you at a young age to be attracted to this path?
Well, I was born and raised in Italy. I spent most of my time there in the middle of the Arc of the Alps in this region called the Dolomite region. It's a really beautiful country. And
yeah.
Part of life there involves, in the summertime, going up above the tree line and just looking around for plants and looking around for mushrooms. And we do a lot of foraging, and we can stuff, and we make teas for winter. And it really was not something I thought of a lot when I was 7, 8, 9 years old. We moved to the United States, which is where my mom is from, when I was 14, fairly permanently. And it took me 2 or 3 years to realize that I was missing this element of sort of daily walks in the woods and yearly rituals of harvesting the same plants and using teas in the winter. At the same time, I was developing a lot of sort of my interests as, you know, a high school kid. I was getting really into Eastern philosophy and occultism and mysticism, and from a Western perspective too, the Western occult sciences and hermeticism and all of that sort of good stuff. But at the same time, a real fascination and love for chemistry and biochemistry, sort of the occult in the scientific realm, you know, that little tiny stuff that we can't see but that's going on inside us and around us all the time. And I felt pulled in these two directions. You know, am I going toward the spirit, or am I going toward, you know, the hard science? And when I realized that this sort of cultural element of my life, this herbal medicine that had been a part of my life as a kid, was really missing, I realized that this kind of incorporated both of these passions that were developing in me into one amazing art and science, which is what herbal medicine, I think, is. And, you know, I was sitting in a tree, and I remember this clearly to this day. It was a beech tree, and she, not with specific words, but kind of gave me the go-ahead. She was like, you love this stuff. You need to go study it. It incorporates all of the passion for science and all of the passion for spirit that you have into one beautiful discipline. And I didn't look back. So I traveled around the country starting at about age 18 for 2 or 3 years, and then settled in Vermont with my wife in 1996. And we started.
So was that the first time that you felt that a plant spirit had actually communicated with you, or had that happened before?
You know, I think it happened when I was a kid. I just didn't really think much of it. I would, and I remember my sister and I would go on walks in the woods outside my grandmother's house, and we would find plants and we would just hang out and sit with them, or we would make little sort of moss altars on stones and bring plants there and just hang out and kind of talk to what I thought were very normal, real presences. But I never thought much of it, and it felt like playtime. You know, and it really took me being sort of going through the teenage years, moving to suburban Kansas City, which is a little bit of a different environment than the Dolomites, and missing that to really realize that there was value.
Just a tiny bit different.
Yeah, just a tiny bit. I was like, these roads are bigger than anything I've ever seen.
Right. Well, you know, it's so interesting as you talk about your early life in Italy. It sounds so magical, and it also sounds like it happened hundreds of years ago. I mean, it doesn't even sound like it's in contemporary time. So it's like old world. I mean, making your own cheese and going for walks in the woods and everything you've just described. It just sounds so wonderful. And what a shock it must have been when you came to the United States and that part of your life was left behind.
Well, you know, I guess I was super excited about what the United States had to offer. It's a very seductive and cool culture in many ways, and I think there's wonderful things about American culture. So it took me a few years for really, you know, the excitement of a 14-year-old moving to this place where, you know, there's lots of television and big cars and music and cool clothes and culture. And anyway, that was super fun, and I had a great time, and I still love the American culture dearly. It took me a few years to realize that those sort of old world elements were something that I also really valued and that were important to me, and that they were a way to kind of reconnect and nourish this desire for sort of spirit and occult connection that I'd had, you know, definitely since I can remember. I also would play with my sister. We would make up strange pseudo-religious rituals together. I don't know. I don't need to go into it too much. But this
sounds like you guys had a
ball. With spirit
and,
you know, connection to things that are unseen has always been something that has really, really been important to me.
Well, that is important.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, you know, we had another guest on the show last month, Kathy Duffy, who's also an herbal expert, and she always travels to Ireland every year. She has a home there and spends several months there. And she always talks about the fairy kingdom and how the fairies over there, that whole just image of the fairy kingdom being involved with plants, that's very big in her own way of working with herbs and developing the kinds of things that she developed, like the herbal bandage that she talked about and things like that. So all of this, when you talk about the unseen dimensions, certainly is something we can understand. It's a part of what we do on Supernatural Girls and what we talk about. So you can feel free to share any of that here along with the science of what you've written in this absolutely beautiful book, The Wild Medicine Solution, Healing with Aromatic, Bitter, and Tonic Plants. It is a beautiful book, Guido. It is just beautifully done. And there is a lot of science that you offer with all of this that doesn't take away from the unseen dimensions. But there's just so much in here. You've got recipes. You've got just all kinds of ways to harvest things. It's really a great book.
Oh, thanks so much. I really enjoyed putting it together, and, you know, at times late at night, really felt like the plants that I've gotten to hang out with in the garden and in the forest were, you know, they were there with me at the keyboard a lot of the times. And I really appreciate your words. Thank you.
I do want to
say that, you know, the science is getting more and more solid around the use of medicinal plants over the last even 10, 15 years. And like you say, in no way detracts from those spiritual elements, like what you were talking about, the fairy kingdom, which have been so important for herbalists forever. And a lot of times, you know, I talk to skeptical folks. My wife is a physician, and, you know, I get to work with a lot of excellent physicians. They're rigorously trained in sort of academic science. So they always look at things with a very critical and skeptical eye, right?
Yeah.
Which is great, and I really appreciate that. But we also have to remember that these traditional ways of sitting to plants and talking to, like, a flower deva that might be living in her, or really a spirit of a garden or the spirit of a valley, I mean, scientists are doing this all the time. They just call it ecological science or systems mm-hmm. theory.
Right.
We're really talking about something you can't see with human eyes that has life to it and that permeates something that we would consider like a flower or a garden to not have limbs and the ability to communicate in the way we do. But nevertheless, we're starting to recognize that ecologies and ecosystems and bioregions have sort of personalities. And so is it that much of a stretch to think that in some way we can understand them and communicate with them and gain sort of very direct knowledge from them without having to take them into a lab and break down their individual constituents?
Mm-hmm. Well, nature spirits of plants and especially trees and guardians of areas are very, very vocal. And
I agree.
The way they vocalize, you know, as a medium, I don't necessarily hear a voice, but it's definitely a clear vibration and a message or information that they want to relay to us. And it's really amazing. And I don't normally connect with plants and the nature world sort of on a daily basis, but they're very present, very present. So I'm not surprised that they helped you with your book.
That's right. Yeah, you know, and so scientists are starting to understand that. They just talk about it in much more objective terms rather than talking about vibration. But when you say vibration, we're talking about, you know, the personality that is a network of relationships in a given ecosystem. And when you put that all together, just like the networks of relationships inside a human body, you really get an entity. It's the only way to describe it. You know, the ecology, the bioregion is a being. And, yeah, they don't use English a lot of the time, but these beings are definitely noticeable, tangible, really useful, and can help guide healing, as well as, you know, a really, I think, important part of a human being. Because what are we except kind of parts of that, you know? And that's the point I try to make in the book, is that these plant chemicals that we've been researching and we've seeing how they work inside the human body to help with our mental health, to help with our digestive health, to help, you know, prevent cardiovascular disease and cancer. These plant chemicals are sort of hormones of a bigger organism that we're a part of. They're cross-kingdom signal molecules. And one way I'd like to talk about it is that they're sort of molecular expressions of love or connection from the plant world and the mushroom world to us. And the plants miss us. The ecology misses us, and they want us out there. They want us communing with them. They want us getting our hands dirty and making tea, and that's a big drive and impetus for me in writing this book, is to make super safe, accessible, easy ways of getting those plants back into your life readily available.
Well, can I ask you a question about that? What I've found when I go to cut my herbs or a flower is I ask them, and they seem very willing to offer themselves to us. They know that they're in service to the planet and to humanity. And it seems to me that they don't mind that we take part of them to use for our own health. And have you found that to be true?
You know, I generally have. there are certainly some exceptions. There's some plants out there that are very, I'd say, private, and they like wild places. You know, they grow up on cliff sides or in the middle of crazy bogs, you know, that you have to get up to your knees in muck to go find them. And when you get to them, they're kind of like, well, hey, how are you doing? Why don't we just sit for a second? But, you know, I don't really appreciate you ripping my root out of the ground right now, if you don't mind.
Okay.
But generally, the garden plants and the medicinal herbs that I talk about in the book and the ones that are sort of, you know, the Irish hedgerow or the English hedgerow plants or the ones that kind of grow in the cow pasture in Italy, where I grew up, or that you find by the trail side, these are plants that love human beings. They even need human beings in order to grow. If you let a field go, you're going to lose the red clover and the yarrow. You're not going to find them anymore quite so much. If you don't have a really good compost pile, you're not going to see really good nettles growing by the side of your house, for instance. So these are plants which are sort of our buddies. They're our allies, but they're also our companions. Mm-hmm. And they've been around forever, and they love being a part of our life. I really think so. Now, there have been certain situations when I walked in the woods and, you know, I've gone out to a skullcap patch and I sit there kind of with my feet in the moist stream side where the skullcap likes to grow. And, you know, there's a break in the forest canopy and the light is coming in there, and I just sit for a little while. And in this spot, there's usually a great abundance of this plant, which is so good for the nervous system. But one year I went out there and I don't know if there were some stressed-out deer or if somebody had munched the skullcap down quite a bit, and I needed some for extraction, but I really didn't get the feeling. The plant felt sort of under pressure and a little bit stressed itself, and it was very clear that it wanted to have a little bit of space and a chance to set more seed and replenish its population. So by and large, I think plants are very willing, and they miss us. They want us there, helping ourselves with them, because I think it helps them too, then there are some situations where, you know, they don't. And like any good partner, you know, just keep your ears open, right? And if you do that, you'll know. The first thing that comes into your heart and into your spirit most of the time is the correct answer. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you that.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard from indigenous people that our medicine is usually within a certain range of where we live. I forget how many yards or feet or, you know, a half mile or something, but I've heard this from a lot of Native American medicine people that I've studied with. And certainly on my property here, we've got this incredible influx of colt's foot and
melon
and milk thistle, which drives me nuts because you go to get rid of that and it's hard. It just grows everywhere here. So, you know, I look at those plants and I'm like, well, clearly they're giving me a message. Not only do they like living here, but
right. This
might be my medicine. So is that something that you talk about also in your lectures and in your book about, you know, this your medicine could be growing right in your backyard?
Well, I think there's that's a really rich point, and there's two really, I think, important sides to that comment. And the first is that nature shows us what we need. And to a certain extent, I think that's really, really true. You see it in folks who live in urban settings where the dandelion and mugwort, like two excellent bitters, break through the pavement, you know, trying to get up into people's lives. Or you get all these good respiratory tonics like mullein and coltsfoot around your house. Absolutely. So I think plants do creep in when they're needed, especially when they're unique plants that you haven't seen before and your meadow or your garden bed starts to have these new folks, these new plant beings coming in, there might be something worth paying attention to right there. But the other side of that is that plants have their roots in the soil, and their leaves, the flowers, their branches, in the air we breathe, they taste the same water. They sit in the same soil we walk on. And the chemistry that they elaborate is really tied into what they're experiencing in the environment that we're also experiencing. So, for instance, when plants experience drought, and presumably if they experience drought, our garden isn't going to be as productive. They change and increase the amount of these cellular protective chemicals called bioflavonoids. And if we're drinking and eating these plants, these medicinal ones, you know, that aren't really super nutritive but have been our allies for a long time, then we sort of get a jump on the environmental change that is going to affect us they're like the canary in the coal mine because they're much more sensitive to ecological shifts, and they change the chemistry, right? And we're eating them locally. We're getting them in our lives on a daily basis. Our chemistry changes because their chemistry changes, and we become more prepared and adaptable and resilient to the environmental change, which to
me
has been incredibly fascinating.
That is fascinating. You know, because I remember a long time ago, Slow Turtle, who was the head medicine man for the Northeast, you know, he often talked about how Native Americans were, you know, they would walk around in hardly any clothing sometimes in very cold temperatures. They had adapted, like what you're talking about. And I was thinking, how did they adapt? You know, I couldn't go outside in cold with no clothes on. I mean, it just wouldn't work for me. But, you know, when you talk about this in this way, that you become really involved in a major way, cellularly, with the environment. That's an amazing point that you just made. Really amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, it's definitely true. And the flip side to that also is that human beings are awesome. We're really strong, incredible animals and highly adaptable. But we can't do it alone, ultimately. You know, no living being can thrive in a vacuum. And we've lost a little bit of our adaptability, I think, by sort of insulating ourselves and separating ourselves from nature. And to a certain extent, that's important, you know. You got to have a wall and a fireplace in winter, especially up here in the Northeast. That makes good sense. I don't think I could walk around naked and harvest plants in the parks in the middle of January up here. But we also tend to be a little more fragile now. People get concerned about you know, everything in the environment. And I see in my clients who walk into clinic, for instance, you know, a lot of fear around different foods, around different chemicals, and around the exposures that we have in modern life. I was talking with this amazing physician, Girona Lodog, MD. I don't know if you guys have heard of her, but she's a pretty incredible herbalist and doctor. And she was saying, you think today's world is toxic? Come sit with me in a hogan in January and, you know, down in New Mexico and burn a nice, you know, wood fire in this low-ceiling hogan, and you tell me who's exposed to more stuff, you know, a primitive human being, quote-unquote, or a human being in the 21st century. We get exposed to a lot of stuff, but humans have been exposed to a lot of stuff forever. And the point is we can handle it a whole lot better if we connect to our botanical allies, to these beings that have always walked with us, to these beings that are really like part of us, they're an extension of us. If we're organs in the ecology and they're organs in the ecology as a spirit and as a being works best when everyone's communicating, you know, everyone's working together.
Yes, that really makes a lot of sense. It really does. That's a phenomenal point.
Guido, can you tell us what your website is?
Well, I work at the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism, which is three-year clinical herb school and community clinic and nonprofit here in Vermont, and it's vtherbcenter.org. VT is for Vermont, herbcenter.org. And I also write a blog where I talk about my book a little bit and post occasional essays. The blog is called A Radical, and radical is spelled R-A-D-I-C-L-E, which really means the, you know, tiny, tiny root of a plant. Which is taken from my friend David Hoffman's comment that we should all be radicals. We should all be like little roots burrowing down into the soil and changing the culture like a plant would or like a dandelion would, breaking up concrete on a tarmac.
That's great.
And people can buy your book on Amazon. Do you have another place where they can buy your book as well?
Amazon is
the solution. Yeah,
the Wild Medicine Solution is available on Amazon and at independent booksellers as well, Barnes & Noble, all of the sort of major places.
Great. Well, we're going to take this opportunity to take a break right now, okay, Guido? And we'll be right back in just a few minutes. If you have a question for Guido, you can call in at 646-478-0828. Thank you for staying tuned. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Your property tax bill. Have you seen it lately? It's frightening. Your property taxes are going up while your home value is going down. It's time to fight back and win. For the real truth about the property tax system, get attorney Pat Quintilian's book, Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Attorney Quintilian answers all your questions and gives you the facts you need to fight a property tax bill that is spiraling out of control. You'll also read about what happens to property owners who don't check their property records, only to find out too late they're taxed on square footage, fixtures, and even buildings that they don't own. Is this happening to you? Learn your rights. Buy attorney Pat Quintilian's book today. Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Available on Amazon.com.
Sometimes life can be a challenge. Would you like insight and guidance to help you make the best choices right now? Contact Helene at angelslighthouse.com to make your personal appointment for a psychic reading or energy alignment. Helene is a direct channel to the angelic realm and is remarkably capable of connecting to the living as well as to your loved ones on the other side. Helene is available to clients all over the world via phone or Skype, and it's simple to set up a group reading anywhere. Visit angelslighthouse.com, where you'll find an easy way to schedule right online. And while you're there, sign up for the Angels Lighthouse newsletter and receive information on all the free energy circles, giveaways, and jewelry with a message. Visit angelslighthouse.com and contact Helene today.
Thank you, everyone, for staying tuned and listening to this fascinating discussion with Guido Massey, author of the book, The Wild Medicine Solution. And it is just so, I don't know, it's so invigorating to hear you talk about the world of nature in this way as both a scientist and a spiritual practitioner, Guido.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
And again, like, that's why I really love herbal medicine, because it lets you do both of those things, which I always thought were going to be pulling me in opposite directions in life.
Mm. Well, it sounds like you find a way to bring them together. And we've got lots and lots of questions in the chat room tonight, and I also have some questions for you on
Great.
How to harvest certain things. So one of the questions that somebody has written in is all about bitters. They really would like to know about them, how to use them, you know, anything you can share that would be helpful to the person asked question in our audience tonight.
Well, bitters are one of my favorite categories of plants, and that's what I try and do in this book, is sort of simplify the vast field of herbal medicine into sort of three really safe and accessible classes of plants, and bitters is right up there as being probably one of the most important for this culture and one of the ones that we miss the most. So a bitter really is anything that tastes bitter, and it really comes from the plant world, and it comes from these wild plants. We've largely bred bitterness out of everything in our diet, and, you know, you think about the way bread is manufactured even. We don't have a lot of bitter bran or sort of that outer part of the grain in our food anymore, let alone, you know, artichoke leaves or dandelion greens or burdock roots. So these bitter-tasting wild plants, and they're basic baseline is that they sort of shock our digestion into waking up. And our digestion is more than just our belly, really. It's also our liver, which sort of molecularly digests the stuff we absorb. So first we have to kind of break things down from big chunks, you know, with our teeth and our stomach muscles into smaller mush. And then we have to molecularly start to break those down so we can absorb individual sugars and amino acids and fats. But then all of the chemistry beyond those macronutrients that we get into our bloodstream goes straight to the liver. And so bitters help with all of the processes. As soon as you taste something bitter, your production of saliva goes up, and all your digestive secretions come into line as well. better enzyme production, and better liver function. And as a result, you know, not only do you see a whole heck of a lot less in terms of symptoms in digestion, you know, less heartburn, less bloating, and less spasm, regular bowel function when bitters are used, but you also see a sort of ongoing, gentle, daily detoxification that comes from just a little more attention and function in the liver. It's interesting to me to note that the chemicals like bitter iridoids or lactones or flavonoids that are found in a lot of these plants, from mugwort and angelica to dandelion and yellow dock, they really are essential components of the sort of chemical environment that the liver needs to function properly. The liver is just kind of sitting around most of the time when you give it food from the Western diet. The digestion, too, it's kind of like, did you really eat something? I think that was just a piece of white bread. Did anything really come through there? Because there's nothing that really wakes your belly up anymore. You know, we worked hard as a culture and as a species for thousands and thousands of years. We ate and foraged all sorts of nasty, bitter-tasting stuff. And so when the Industrial Revolution gave us the chance to really sit back, stop working, and really eat a lot of sweet all the time, we took it and we ran with that chance. So we recognized that moving our bodies is kind of an important thing, you know, going for walks a few times a week and maybe going for a more challenging hike a few times during the summer. That's important and good for us. But we haven't really made that shift as a culture towards the importance of challenging our palates, our taste buds, and that's what the bitter flavor does. So it's amazing for any digestive problem, but it also ensures ongoing daily detox. The image I have is one that I was really cemented in my mind from when I was growing up. You'd be pedaling home from, you know, we do sports in the afternoon after school, and I get on my bike and go back home. It's about a 15-minute bike ride through the cobblestone streets. And at these espresso bars, there'd be these old-timers sitting there. And, you know, where you got your espresso and where you got your liquor and wine is kind of all the same thing in Italy. And they'd be watching the soccer game, and they'd have this glass of amaro or bitter at the table, and they'd just be drinking it down and maybe then having another espresso in the hour before dinner time. And this cultural ritual of having something bitter before you eat is something that you see in Europe, definitely, but it's also an important part of the medicine of Asia. You even see it in Africa and in South American cultures. It's universal, and the only reason that it's not in the American diet anymore is because we don't have that sort of cultural root to our practice.
Well, we're more salt and sugar, and don't you think we've kind of boiled it down to those two tastes?
Definitely, sweet and salty.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, they awaken reward pathways in our brain that actually are very similar to the reward pathways awakened by cocaine. This guy, Kessler, wrote a book called The End of Overeating, and he was a former FDA commissioner, and he really talks about how the food industry knows that we like sweet and salty and makes it so that that plus the mouthfeel of fat are front and center in every processed food that we find. And that's the thing. We find that stuff everywhere. What we don't find anywhere are the bitters. So you can make bitters really easily by just harvesting the dandelions out of your garden, chopping them up, and putting them in vodka. You let them sit in vodka for a month, and you strain it out. You've got a very simple bitter extract that you can use to help with digestive problems. But it's endless creativity, right? You can get more bitter things like artichoke leaves, and then something that has a little bit more of a spice to it, like ginger or cinnamon, if you'd like. And you can flavor that dandelion root, put them in the vodka as well, and let them sit for a month. So you can really custom tailor it to kind of what your favorite flavors are and your personality is, so that the plant's personality and your personality can merge and, you know, have a party in your belly, and your gut will really thank you for it.
I can't wait
now,
to try this.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's fascinating.
Really easy.
You know, when we talk about bitters, though, you're a person who's going out into nature and harvesting these things. What is your opinion of what you can find in your local supermarket? Is it the same bitter that you find out in nature?
You know, a lot of it is. There's actually been, I think, a great revival and resurgence of sort of craft custom bitters. And I sometimes joke that the way in to the American culture for herbal medicine is going to be through the bar. But what you find at the grocery store, there's really one brand that you see most often, and that's the Angostura bitters. And they're fine. They're based on gentian, and gentian is a very bitter plant, very classic flavor. Well, I find that they're a little bit salty. They do add a little bit of extra salt, and, you know, they're a little bit commercial. But if that's all you can get a hold of, they're still going to help your digestive tract. I'm lucky enough to work for a company called Urban Moonshine that is making some excellent digestive bitters that you can find at Whole Foods and at many natural food stores around the country. But there's classic brands like Peychaud's Bitters, a great company in Canada called Bitter Sling, and there's Bitterman's Bitters. You can find these at gourmet stores and at sort of natural food grocery stores in a lot of places now. And that makes me really excited because I'm hoping that part of this sort of local food, whole food revival is going to include these plants that aren't really food plants, but that are super important allies of ours that like reestablish that ecological connection that we've always had.
Now, with these bitters, are you saying that we should take them pre-meal so that they inspire our digestion to do its thing, or can they also be taken after a meal? What do you recommend?
You can do it both ways. The way I usually boil it down is that you take them pre-meal if you end up with a lot of sort of bloating and lower symptoms, you know, lower down, belly button and below, where your intestines are kind of griping and cramping, or you have any kind of irregularity in your bowel habits. Taking bitters before meals will really help with that. After meals,
that help, does that help intestinal disorders like IBS and Crohn's and that kind of thing?
Yes, it would definitely help. IBS is something that, you know, irritable bowel syndrome is something that bitters definitely help with. Where you have chronic autoimmune inflammatory diseases like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, you probably should consult with a qualified herbalist because there's something more usually that needs to be done to kind of help adjust immune function there. And bitters can still be helpful, but they don't usually do the whole thing because that's a little more serious of an issue. And but it certainly would not hurt to try that in moderation before you eat. You take bitters after...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that after meals, bitters are great for indigestion and heartburn. They really help close the valve between the throat and the stomach, the esophagus and the stomach, so that no more acid spills up in there, and they can relieve that feeling of sort of, oh, my goodness, I had way too much. It's what we call Thanksgiving dinner syndrome, you know. You just went for that second slice of pumpkin pie, and you kind of regret it, and you take a little bit of bitters afterwards, and you just feel a whole lot better.
That's terrific. Now, I have another question for you from the chat room. They would like to know, are bitters good for heavy metal poisoning? Because it's you're saying it has something to do with the function of the liver. So is that something that people can take and detox?
Well, heavy metals, things like lead, but also more intense metal toxins like mercury, which are common from old dental fillings, and even more toxic ones like chromium or arsenic, which actually you can find in drinking water in a lot of places in the Northeast, arsenic. These accumulate in the body, and they're neurotoxins, and they can also be toxic to muscle and heart muscle. And so you got to get them out, basically, right? And so getting a handle on heavy metals involves two things. One is getting them out, and the other is protecting the body while they're leaving, because they leave through the bloodstream, and they can damage the blood vessels as they go. They leave through the liver and through the kidneys, and they can damage those excretory organs as they leave also. So it's kind of a two-step process, right? You need something that, quote-unquote, chelates or attaches itself to the metal to bring it out of the fat tissue or the nerve tissue where it's kind of lodged itself. And then you need to protect the body as it's leaving so that you don't cause this sort of inflammatory spike as you're detoxifying.
Right.
And bitters help in the second part. So they help protect the liver and they protect the bloodstream from the sort of acute toxicity that comes when you're chelating, starting to chelate out the heavy metals. But you also need something to actually get at them, right? And again, I would encourage you to consult with an herbal practitioner or with a botanically minded physician in order to go through a good and safe regime for getting rid of the particular heavy metals that you're concerned with. But bitters would be a great adjunct to that, and I would focus on a bitter that maybe had something like milk thistle, that wonderful plant, I think, Patricia, that you were talking about.
Yeah, I was complaining about it everywhere
ago.
Here.
Yeah. Well, it's probably our best liver-protected plant, And the flavolignans in it are excellent in ensuring that the liver gracefully and swiftly gets rid of stuff that is not useful to us and that could potentially be toxic to us.
Now, let me ask you about the milk thistle, because, as I mentioned, it's growing everywhere, and it has those really nasty spikes on it. So
you try to
pull the plant out, and you can just get stabbed all over your hand. How do you recommend harvesting something like that? And do you use the root, the leaves, the flower? What do you use?
Traditionally, the it's a biennial, or, you know, if you have a long enough growing season, it can do its seeding in 1 year. So traditionally, the leaf was used as a little bit of a bitter, but the seeds were the part that were most often employed. And I'll tell you, if you think the leaves are sharp, the seed is even worse, the seed head. I use wood stove gloves, those thick leather gloves,
Wow.
you know, that you use to kind of like put your hand on the hot metal wood stove when you're trying to open the door. And they get you like 90% of the way there on popping open the milk thistle head. But when it's ripe and the plant's kind of gone tan and lost the greenness of summer, you take the seed head and you just pry it open like you would an artichoke,
mm-hmm.
and the seeds just fall out. And the seeds are the most active part medicinally.
Loaded and you can put that in vodka and make your own bitter out of it?
You could, yes, absolutely. Or you can just, you have to winnow it. It's interesting because there's this sort of fiberglassy stuff in with the seed. So it all falls out into your basket, you know, seed and fuzz. And then on a windy day, you take your basket and you kind of toss the whole contents up into the air. And the wind blows the fuzz away and the seeds that are so dense fall right back into the basket.
Oh, my goodness.
And when you've got that, you can just grind it up. And you can put it in oatmeal or you can put it in cooked rice or any kind of grain that you're fond of, and just eat a couple of tablespoons a day. It's got a really nice nutty flavor and mixes really well with that. If you feel inspired, I don't think that'll work quite as well.
Hmm.
Mixing it with something makes it a little more palatable.
Mm-hmm. Because this will have a bitter taste, yes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so this is considered a bitter. Okay.
So, you know, don't put it in your mushroom and brown rice casserole, but maybe put it in, you know, half a cup of that as the first part of your meal. So you don't spoil the whole thing with bitterness, but you also get a good concentrated dose of that milk thistle. And you can buy the milk thistle seed. It's really cheap, $9 a pound for organic milk thistle seed. It's readily available. And then you can just bypass the whole stabbing in the hands part.
Yeah. Yeah, that is very unpleasant, I must tell you. And you know that, too. I love your idea with the fireplace gloves. That makes a lot of sense to use something like that. I even tried, I had this very thick towel. And I thought, I'm just going to try to wrap it around the plant and pull this thing out by the roots. And it went right through the towel. It was like a double-layered thick towel. Those things are sharp. Ugh.
Yeah, you need something like leather or Kevlar.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I can't imagine many insects or animals bothering that plant.
Right. Yeah. And that's really interesting you bring that up, actually, because it seems that a lot of these bitter-tasting molecules were originally insecticides that the plants made to protect themselves from being eaten. And we still have sort of an ancestral memory of that in our system, where tasting bitterness makes us think that we've ingested something that could potentially be poisonous, which is why all of our detoxification machinery wakes up. You know, and I tell the story in the book of this king a couple thousand years ago in what is now Turkey in the Mediterranean basin, and how obsessed he was with poison and how he really, I think, came up with the first sort of high-test detoxifying antitoxin bitter formula, at least in the Western world.
Hmm. Well, again, I just love talking about all this because I love this whole topic of health and especially the place where you can do these things yourself. You can either forage them yourself or, like you said, you can spend $9 and get a pound of organic milk thistle seeds and then work with that on your own. But I'm a big proponent of that. I know, Helene, you are too, that it's important, I think, to take your health back and to take these things into your own hands as much as you can. I mean, certainly you want to consult a physician whenever you need to, but there's also some other things you can do to ensure better health, and better digestion is key for everything.
Well,
it is the root of health, quite literally, right?
Yeah.
Well,
I think it's amazing how much it's come into the forefront even in the last few years. as far as all of this being readily available. And if people don't have a Whole Foods type market near them, it's absolutely available all over the internet, right?
Well, yeah, and you know, it always amazed me that people who are so into, you know, having their own garden and homesteading and you know, nourishing their families with stuff that grows out of the soil or that they get at farmers market locally, are taking care of themselves using you know, pharmaceuticals or even, you know, crazy concoctions that they might get at a health food store that come from really faraway places and are extremely packaged and processed. I just don't get it. You know, these plants are really effective. There's historical use, there's amazing folklore and spiritual lore around them, and there's great scientific clinical research. And they're ridiculously easy to grow. You know, try not growing a dandelion, and yet it is one of our best bitters, and it's the answer to so many ailments of the digestive tract that people who walk into my clinic are complaining about on a daily basis. The stuff is in your lawn, you know. Try avoiding the Roundup and pulling some of those suckers up by hand and eating them. I think that it's not only really empowering, but we also, who are into this stuff, have a responsibility to get the word out about it. And that's why I really appreciate both of you having me on the show, you know, and being willing to talk about this and being interested in it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we are in total agreement with you, and this kind of information does need to come out, and people can take advantage of this. They can get your book, The Wild Medicine Solution, and read about the science behind this, as well as all of your wonderful recipes that are in here for teas and tonics and bitters and everything else. So, and I even saw some things like salads, I think. So I can't wait to try them. It's great.
Bring it back into the kitchen, you know. That's definitely something that, as herbalists, I think we all feel really passionate about. And, again, I took for granted when I was a little kid, but I really realize it is so important, despite the fact that it's kind of in the background and just part of the daily routine there. It's so important to get that to be a part of the new wonderful local whole food vibrant culture in the United States. Make these trace phytochemical sources, these wild weedy botanicals, a big part of that.
That's great. I think it'll make a big difference for everybody. It really will. Well, let's see. I see we've got a caller here, Helene. Should we take the caller now?
We absolutely can. We're welcoming Becky in Texas. She's live on the line. Hello, Becky. How are you tonight?
Great. How are you?
I'm fine.
We're great.
Do you have a question for Guido tonight?
I do. You know, I live out in the country, and I'm on about 2.5 acres, and I have wild 4 o'clocks. I mean, they're everywhere, and purple verbena also. Mm. Is that, and we don't poison out here at all. You know, everybody poisons everything, but we don't use any pesticides on our property at all. We have our vegetable gardens and whatever. And we have a lot of ladybugs. You know, we don't have a lot of bugs that we have to worry about because we haven't poisoned, and so the good bugs are taking care of the bad bugs. But I was really interested if there's any medicinal properties that you can use 4 o'clocks in verbena.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Becky. And it sounds wonderful out there, actually. On your homestead, the 4 o'clocks are they're not much in use anymore, but herbalists would call them sort of cooling and demulcent. And what that means is that they sort of can help when consumed regularly ensure a little bit less inflammation in the body and also soothe tissue. That's what we mean by demulcent, is they're kind of slimy. The seed can be harvested and pressed into a useful oil, but I don't think that's really easy for us to do at home. So herbalists would take the whole plant and they would steep it into tea and drink it to kind of just soothe a dry cough or soothe the irritation of heartburn, or use for a constitution or a person who might have dry skin and predisposition to skin rashes or eczema or psoriasis or stuff like that. It's going to be a very mild remedy, but it would be safe and okay to use on a fairly regular basis. It's an evening primrose relative. And now with verbena, I wonder if you're talking about, you know, a vervain. Is this a really bitter plant, or is it one that has more of a scent, an aromatic quality to it, like, you know, a lemon verbena would?
It has a little bit of a scent to it, yes.
Yeah. So then it's probably a closer cousin to, you know, the beloved plants like lemon verbena. And if it's not too bitter, you could probably brew it into a tea. And any of these aromatic or highly scented plants are going to have a positive effect on the nervous system. They generally, you know, any plant with a decent amount of an aromatic quality to it or a scent to it has both a relaxing and stimulating quality to the human physiology, which I know is a little bit hard to understand, but they get into our insides when we consume them as a tea, and they can enliven a situation that's kind of sluggish or underactive. So people tend to be sad or depressed or have a hard time getting going in the morning. Some of that tea from the wild blue verbena might help. But conversely, if there's too much tension and you know, the back muscles get tight and the neck gets tight, and you want to help with, you know, worry or anxiety and kind of calm down towards sleep in the evening, making a tea with just about a tablespoon of dried leaves in a cup of hot water would be a great way to kind of unwind and get away from the stress of the day.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. That sounds so. You do recommend not just having them, picking them, and using them directly. You need to dry them first.
Well, I think a lot of times when you want to make a tea, that's the best way to do it. You can use it fresh, in which case you might want to make like a sun tea, you know, in a big glass jar, like you would with peppermint or spearmint. But when you dry these plants that have smell, it sometimes makes the smell more pronounced. It brings it out a little bit, and you can get a little more into your cup of tea and make it just a little stronger and more medicinally active.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, thank you so much. This is just a great show. It's really interesting. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Becky,
for calling in. This is great questions that you asked.
Thanks.
Good night.
Good night.
That was great.
Thanks, Becky.
That was really great. So I have just a little story. When I was a very young person, my former in-laws were from Italy. They are from Italy. And I'll never forget meeting them. And then within a week of meeting them, they were out in the yard with their little tined garden tool picking all the new dandelions out of the grass. And I was saying, boy, these people are really particular. You know, and the next thing I know, all the dandelions are on the counter picking the leaves off, and they're putting them in the water to soak. And I'm saying, what are you doing? And it was hard to understand them at that moment, but basically they were going to eat the dandelions, and I was absolutely horrified. You know, I was all of 20, but I was horrified, and they explained to me very clearly, no, you have to eat this, you know. It's important to eat this, and they made a big, you know, salad out of some of it, and they made, actually sautéed some of it, you know, and I tasted it, and I liked it, and I was quite shocked. It was amazing to me that you could go out in your yard and find things to eat, but then I found that they were always doing things like that. They knew where to get mushrooms and, you know, all of that, and I think, you know, the culture in Europe and other parts of the world is so old that people understand this connection better. It's just passed down and passed down. And what has happened to the American culture, do you think, that we're deluded into this salt and sugar addiction that processed foods have caused us? And it's been an intentional kind of thing for these big companies to want us to be addicted to this. Why do you think it happened here and not in other places?
I think it's a complicated question, but one is that, you know, the food companies have recognized what sells food. And I will tell you, you know, selling a cookie or a sweet snack with a lot of fat in it is going to be a lot easier than selling dandelion leaf salad, though I love that story. And, you know, you have to eat this. That's exactly right. But so what we're seeing, too, is that embracing this food that is really sweet and salty and processed is really easy to do, and it's very easy to slip slip into kind of an addictive pattern with it.
It's absolutely addictive.
And you know what helps break the addiction incredibly enough is tasting the bitter flavor. You notice this really clearly if you walk into a grocery store when you're hungry. Try this next time. If you have a little bit of something bitter that you made and you take it before you walk into that store, you're not going to put as many cookies and chips in your cart. It's remarkable. Because if you're hungry, your brain kind of just goes on autopilot and you go straight for these things. And the food companies know this, right? And so I really think that, you know, one part of it is it's their fault, of course. You know, they're putting this stuff out there. They know it's addictive. They know it makes money. It's kind of like the tobacco industry. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, we've shot ourselves in the foot, so to speak, by not having any of these wild, bitter plants as part of our culture.
Mm.
If we did, we would eat this stuff less. And you see in Italy and in France and European cultures that even though there is this sort of exporting of the American diet and the fast food culture, there isn't as much diabetes, there isn't as much cardiovascular disease, there isn't as much obesity. And part of that is because the cultural roots that incorporate these bitter plants ongoingly are still strong enough to be able to balance out the sort of American food mentality and the addictive quality of these sugars and salts. Nevertheless, you know, now we're starting to see folks in Japan, traditionally a really lean culture, right, that focuses on very whole foods and very diverse sources of phytonutrients and great foods like wild fish. There's starting to be a lot more obesity. There's starting to be more diabetes and cardiovascular disease as the Western culture gets exported to Japan. So why do I think it's so prevalent here? Why do I think we don't have bitters as part of our culture? I really think that a big part of it is that folks came from different parts of the world to this continent and wanted to leave behind where they were coming from. You see this in linguistics, interestingly enough, when you study language patterns, right? A lot of folks that I talk to whose grandparents emigrated to New York City, for instance, they tell me that I'm trying to teach Italian to my daughter, which is sort of an uphill struggle, you know, but they tell me like, oh, I wish my parents had taught me Italian when we moved here, or they, you know, kept up with Spanish or kept up with Chinese. It just didn't happen because they wanted us to Americanize. They wanted us to assimilate. And often the culture that they came from, a lot of Italians who came to New York City, you know, in the 19th century, came from incredible poverty and famine and war and oppression. And the thought of their home was not a thought that gave them sort of pride and longing. It was more like, we want to leave this behind because our life is horrible, and we want to start fresh, and we want to start new, and we want to be part of this new culture that we're building from the ground up. The problem is that as this culture was built from the ground up, it didn't incorporate these wild plants that have walked beside us for since before we were human. And that's why I think we see it particularly in this continent and in the American culture. And we don't see it as much in the other cultures of the world. It's because there was sort of this wholesale rejection of the deep cultural roots, which included the cuisine, right, the food as medicine that people had been doing for thousands of years everywhere around the planet.
It's a great answer.
That's a fascinating answer, yeah. And it's just amazing to me, you know, you see Europeans and the way they eat. All of their portions are much smaller than here in the U.S. And when they're eating dessert, it's not a giant half a cake. It's a small piece.
You know, it's fascinating.
Cake.
The bitters come in there again, though, I got to say.
Mm-hmm.
They've done scientific research on people. You put people in front of an all-you-can-eat buffet, and you give them a bitter taste in 15 minutes before they eat 30% less. Not because they're putting duct tape on their mouth or because they're forcibly starving themselves as part of a diet. They just get full more quickly. Because the bitter starts the digestive process. You know how they say you really should stop eating 15 minutes before you're full because it takes a while for the signal to get from your gut to your brain that you're actually full? If you consume bitters 15 minutes before you start, the gut and the brain are synchronized. And when you're full, you feel full. And so you don't eat for another 10 minutes. You don't overeat. And this is borne out in scientific research in human beings, which I think is fascinating. And when you look at the neural signaling from gut to brain and you get down into the deep biochemistry of it, you say, like, well, this is why, obviously, this is happening. There's these hormonal signals. There's these neuronal signals. It's all fairly clear. But, that, you know, the old-timer sitting there sipping his Amaro and looking at the soccer game and the bar in the afternoon light in Italy, he doesn't care about any of that. He just does it because it's a cultural ritual. It's part of his cuisine, and he deflects as a result, and he's healthier.
So basically, you're talking about a possible support system for getting rid of obesity in this country, which is a huge problem. Bitters could really help to balance out a lot of the dietary issues, and also not the fact that so many people overeat. So bitters could be a crucial element in people being able to control their weight a lot better.
That's right. That's why I call it the wild medicine solution. You know, I don't think restricting sugar is the answer. It's only part of the answer. Putting the plants in that regulate our system that we've had forever and ever, that our body needs and craves and wants, the plants that want us to use them, you know, that are weedy and wild and live with humans. That's the solution. That's the reason obesity is there to begin with, because we've cut these out of our diet. They're not part of how we regulate our appetite anymore, and so we overeat. I talk to people who walk into my clinic all the time. They're like, I know sugar is bad for me. I'm trying to get on this low-carb diet. I'm trying to go paleo, whatever it is. And I'm having an incredibly hard time. And I looked at them and I'm like, of course you are. This stuff is addictive and you've got an entire food industrial complex pushing it on you.
That's true.
Let's give you some support in terms of bitters. That's what's missing. You don't have any support. You would never ask a smoker to just stop smoking. No, you would try and give them support. You might use plants like lobelia. You might, you know, help their respiratory function. You might look at triggers and situations, right? Really try and work with them. But with people who are trying to restrict sugar and carbohydrate and salt and fat, no one gives them any support in that regard. Bitters are a key support for that. I really think a big part of why we have obesity and diabetes at such high levels is this multi-generational experiment that we've engaged in, which is let's cut out all the bitters, let's quit moving our bodies, and let's go nuts with our sweet and salty cravings.
And that's the recipe for disaster, because that's what we've got right now.
Apparently.
Yes. So, again, this is just great information, Guido. And, again, I want to urge everybody to buy your book, The Wild Medicine Solution, which is available on Amazon.com. Again, this is crucial information. And, you know, this is kind of in line with Ayurvedic medicine also, isn't it? Because they talk about the four different tastes that you have to have things be in balance.
Yeah, five tastes.
Five.
When you include sort of the deliciousness or what the Japanese calls umami flavor. But, yeah, that all of the traditional sciences of life, which is what Ayurveda literally means, you know, the food-based, plant-based health sciences. And Ayurveda is, you know, some people would say potentially 4,000 or 5,000 years old. They always talk about this flavor balance and the importance of having all of them, including the bitter one, absolutely. And you don't only see it in traditional systems of healing like Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine, European medicine, the medicine of East Africa, the medicine of Central America, Native American medicine, but you also see it in biochemical research now. The bitter taste receptor is the most complex receptor in our tongue. It's found on our tongue. It's found throughout our gut. It's found in the liver. It's found in the gall sac. It's even found in nervous system tissue, genital organ tissue, and even in the tissue of the lungs, believe it or not. So this is pervasive, really important stuff. And I'm not saying that we should be eating bitters 24/7 all the time. I'm just saying that it's really an important part of that balance that you were just talking about.
Well, we're definitely out of balance here in this culture, so all of this information is very, very important. I do have a question about the reishi mushroom. Because that's known as, like, the king of healers or something. The power of that mushroom is legend. Is that correct?
It certainly is. Oh, yes, it certainly is. And in Korea and in China, they talk about these purple reishis that grow in, you know, the deepest part of the old growth forests. And if you can find a purple reishi and, you know, eat it for a prolonged period of time, it will add years and years of vibrant life to your lifespan. And, you know, obviously I'm a little skeptical of those stories, but I think they hold substantial truth to them at their core. The mushrooms in general are sort of a fascinating ally. I think of them as being, you know, they grow on reishi mushrooms grow on rotting dead hemlock trees, and mushrooms in general grow on kind of rotting stuff, right?
Right.
Anywhere from cow manure to, you know, the molds that grow on bread. And so the kingdom fungi is like, they're transmute death into life in this incredible way. And, you know, we actually relied on the products of mushrooms for a lot of the really heavy-hitting antibiotics that have been hugely important in the 20th century in terms of fighting infectious disease. But that's not what we're talking about with a mushroom like reishi. Reishi is much more of a gentle tonic. It's incredibly safe. It doesn't do any of the things that an antibiotic would do to our gut flora. It also doesn't, you know, kill pathogens the way an antibiotic does. But what it does is it talks to our immune system. And this is kind of like, you know, another place where our culture and our medical system have kind of gotten a little bit out of balance. Our immune system is amazing. It's incredibly complex. It keeps us healthy in a way that, you know, boggles the mind, considering how barraged with viruses and bacteria we are on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. The fact that we don't, you know, just get turned into mush within 5 hours of being born is remarkable. Because our immune system, you know, has this power to fight pathogens that might want to harm us. But unfortunately, that fire can kind of get out of control, right? And
yes.
You can see autoimmune disease, you can see hypersensitivities and allergies sort of creep up. You can see the fire of inflammation that damages the heart and the blood vessels. And so we've got this sort of immune fire inside us. But like any good fire, we want to make sure it burns, but it doesn't burn too much. The analogy I often use for the immune system is that it's like, you know, a toddler. It's got a lot of energy, but it needs to be directed. And there's a couple ways you can approach the toddler. You know, you can kind of ignore them and not expose them to anything that's interesting or challenging, and then they get bored, right, and they act out. And that's, I think, what's happening a lot with allergies, hypersensitivities, and autoimmune disease. Our immune system is bored because we over-sterilize everything in this culture.
Hmm.
It's actually, you know, a lot of researchers are calling it the hygiene hypothesis now. They studied kids, and they found that kids who grow up in very sterilized environments where, you know, Lysol is used all the time and they don't get to go outside and play in dirt, and they compared them to kids who grew up on farms out in the country with animals and manure and, you know, they're making mud pies and doing everything kids do.
Right.
And the kids who grow up on farms have dramatically lower rates of asthma and allergies compared to the kids who grow up in sterile environments. And the thought is that this crucial amount of immune challenge that is happening when we grow up and when we move through adolescence into adulthood is missing. And as a result, the immune system acts out and starts to freak out on itself. It starts to freak out on tissues of the body. One incredible example is that folks with MS are now being cured by infecting them with hookworms, which is a GI tract parasite that has existed alongside humans for millennia. They go in and they get a hookworm infection artificially given to them, and their MS symptoms start to dissipate, which to me is just fascinating. MS
and why do you think that is? Why do you think the hookworm infestation makes such a difference?
Well, the thought is that in the GI tract, the immune system is kind of creating this situation where the hookworm can't get out of control, and in so doing, it's focusing on the hookworm. And that if we don't have this sort of ability to get the immune system challenged with this particular parasite in this case, then it's possible that it starts to attack some of the proteins that are surrounding nerve tissue that are similar looking to the proteins in the hookworm. And then you get nerve degeneration, nerve inflammation, and demyelination, which lead to poor nerve function, which is what is happening in multiple sclerosis. And when you reintroduce something for the immune system to work on that isn't nerve tissue, it starts to work on that, and it leaves the nerve tissue alone.
So it's exactly what you were saying. It's a redirection of or refocus of the immune system's purpose on something
right.
that's not going to be harmful to the person.
And, I mean, think of how we approach infection in modern medicine. We basically have two strategies. And I think the toddler analogy holds true here, you know. If the immune system is like the toddler and it's trying to fight a bug, we really will either do two things for it. We'll either do its work for it by using an antibiotic, which just kills everything, so the immune system doesn't have to do anything. It's kind of like saying, oh, I see you struggling, trying to, you know, step up those steep stairs or climb on that rock. I'm just going to put you on top of the rock.
Mm-hmm.
The kid doesn't learn anything. No challenge. Boring. Or we see the child struggling, we see the immune system struggling with an autoimmune process, And what do? We tell it to shut up. We yell at it with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or with steroids, which basically turn off the immune system in really powerful ways. You know, when you take a steroid, it just completely shuts off all immune function. That's why it reduces inflammation so much. So that's like telling the toddler no in a really loud voice and not explaining anything and making him sit in the corner. That's not going to do much long-term for their health and well-being. So
right.
Reishi mushroom, right, and astragalus root and these deep immune tonics contain these substances called polysaccharides and proteoglycans. They're basically sugar and protein chains that look remarkably like, when you put them under the microscope and when you expose them to immune cells, they look a lot like the surface markers on things like intestinal worms or viruses or bacteria. So it's basically a way to expose our immune system to stuff that challenges it and talks to it without actually, you know, ingesting a bunch of bacteria or hookworms, which, you know, if you're like me, you probably would rather avoid.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, medicinal plants give us a way to talk to our immune system, engage the toddler in conversation, right? Work with them, challenge them a little bit, give them something, right? Because we don't want to go back to open sewers, you know?
No.
That doesn't make any sense. But
right.
At the same time, we don't want to keep the immune system so sheltered and so coddled that it ends up acting out or being dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
And what we can do with these medicinal plants like reishi mushroom, and what the mushrooms do incredibly well, is really talk to the immune system. So if it's underactive, and we see this in cancer therapy all the time, where we use mushrooms all the time for support therapy in people undergoing chemo, which has ravaged their immune system, or in people fighting cancer who need better immune activity, we give medicinal mushrooms and you see their white blood cell counts go back up, you see their natural killer cell activity increase, and this is corroborated not only in my clinical practice just by looking at these folks' blood work, but also by scientific research. And at the same time, I use reishi mushroom for allergies and autoimmune disease and hypersensitivity to turn down the fire when it's going out of control in situations like MS. Just like bitters help find the balance of digestion or aromatic plants help find the balance of the nervous system, these tonic plants that have polysaccharides in them, like reishi mushroom, balance out the immune system. They get into a conversation with the toddler with the fire rather than telling it to shut up or doing all its work for it. And I think that's why the reishi mushroom is, you know, so associated with immortality. Because if we can tame that fire, if we can control it, then we will live longer. There'll be less inflammation. Our immune system will be stronger. We'll be able to fight pathogens better. All of this is, again, you know, like the Italian folks were saying, not just something that is nice to do, it's something that we have to do. It's something that our body has come to rely on. And the fact that we're not eating any mushrooms anymore, I think, is a big reason why we're seeing a lot more autoimmune disease and a lot more difficult relationship with our internal fire.
That's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the reishi mushrooms. I noticed that they usually come dried, right? So how many times a day would you ingest that, and how would you prepare it?
Almost all mushrooms, they have to be dried or they have to be cooked or something, because they're so good at sort of protecting themselves that if you try and eat them fresh, you're not going to digest them. And this is true of a shiitake or a button mushroom, which are super medicinal too in and of themselves. So you dry them or you cook them first. Reishi, it's not tasty like a shiitake. It's pretty fibrous and woody.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the easiest way to prepare it is to get into the habit of trying to make a soup stock. You know, and I suggest to my clients, you know, once a week or every other week, get a chicken, even get a rotisserie chicken or something, you know, from the grocery store. Eat that chicken and save the bones if you're into meat. If you're not into meat, just cut up a bunch of vegetables, you know, onions and garlic and carrots and celery. Simmer all of that down in a pot, with water for 2 or 3 hours, or put it in a crock pot at the beginning of the day and throw in reishi mushroom slices. For a gallon of water, you know, for a gallon of water, you probably really need only about a cup full of dried reishi, loosely packed. You can never get that stuff, you know. It's pretty fluffy.
Mm-hmm.
You put that in there for every gallon of water, about a cup full of reishi. It doesn't make the flavor that bad. You put it in with a lot of vegetables, with animal bones. Simmer it for 6 to 8 hours, and then you can freeze it. Freeze it in, you know, 8-ounce cup-sized Tupperware containers in the freezer, and then you can use that as a base for stock. You can braise your vegetables and meats in it, Or you can just drink it as a broth with, you know, a little bit of salt or a little bit of olive oil. And it's a great way to get at it medicinally. When we work with cancer patients, we recommend they freeze them in ice cube trays. So you freeze the stock in just ice cube trays, and then you pop out the ice cubes and put them in a plastic bag, 2 to 3 ice cubes a day. There you go.
Okay.
That's
fantastic. That's how I used to make baby food.
Exactly.
Ice cube trays, yeah. That's a fantastic tip there. I love that.
And the reishi mushroom, Helene, that's what I gave you a while back because it grows wild here. But when I've harvested it, here's my question, Guido. It was kind of like rubber at first, and that's what you were saying. It can be kind of woody and all that. Is there like a special time of year that it's best to harvest these things?
In the Northeast, Ganoderma suge, the hemlock varnish shelf, which is a great species of local reishi, it's ripe right now. We usually wait for the new or the full moon a lot of the times after a rain, and certainly this year after a rain has been pretty much any old day of the summer.
Yeah.
So reishis are great right now, and what I usually tell my students is that if you find one, take it, because they are they're going to rot, and they're going to get eaten by bugs relatively quickly once they're mature. So reishi goes through this phase where, you know, it grows out of the hemlock, and there's this little kind of white and then yellow edge to it, and then it eventually turns all red and varnished looking. And if you can get it right when it's all red before the bugs have gotten to it, that's ideal. But if you get it when it's still a little bit white or yellow on the outside, take a sharp knife and cut it off the hemlock tree. Remember where it was, because there probably will be more next year at around the same time.
Oh, okay.
Bring it home and then cut it while it's fresh. It's a lot easier to cut while it's fresh. Slice it into thin slices with a serrated knife. You're not going to be able to do it real easily with sharp, you know, regular chef's knife, but a serrated knife that has kind of some teeth to it. And then string it up somewhere, you know, use a thick needle and run string through those slices while it's still fresh and string it up to dry. And then you'll have reishi slices that you can just preserve in a jar.
And that's the kind of stuff you're saying, put it in and use it as soup stock. You could also probably make a tincture out of that, yes? You could put it in alcohol, or what do you do with that?
You can. I talk about in the book about a sort of two-step process for extracting the medicinal qualities of reishi. They have these amazing inflammation-reducing triterpenes, which are bigger molecules that aren't like those sugar chains, the polysaccharides, and they require a little bit different process. It's a two-phase extract, but I have pretty clear direction. It's not that hard once you do it once. You basically make a tincture, and then you do a little bit of a boiling of some reishi, and you put the two things together.
Okay. Well, I think I have my work cut out for me.
Well, Patricia, you did give me that reishi mushroom, and it was already dried, and so I decided that I would make a tea out of it, so I put boiling water over it and let it sit around for a little bit. And then I tried to drink it, and I went, I don't think so. It just wasn't tasty.
Wasn't for you.
No, but, you know, the idea of putting it in a soup stock is fantastic.
Yeah, it masks that little bit of bitterness, and if you don't need a ton of it. If you dilute it a little that way, it ends up being, I think, a whole lot more palatable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know right where some are on my property, so I'm going to go and harvest them tomorrow, thanks to your advice, so that they'll be nice and fresh.
Oh, that's great. I'll think of you tomorrow doing that.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to have a good time with this. This is wonderful, wonderful.
And Guido Massey's wonderful book is called The Wild Medicine Solution, and you can find it on Amazon.com. And I was a little bit confused about your website, so why don't you give the name of your blog again so that people can find you there, Guido?
Yeah, I'm on Blogger. So it's A Radical, which is aradicle.blogspot.com. But if you do a Google search for my name, Guido, and A Radical, again, RADICLE, the small root that emerges from the seed, you'll find it pretty quickly. And you can find information about the book there, as well as some occasional blog postings from me.
Well, thank you, Guido, and we're going to take this opportunity to take a short break. Thank you, everyone, for staying tuned. We'll be right back. Well, this is Helene Olson, and you can find me at angelslighthouse.com. I'm going to take a few moments to talk to Patricia Baker, my fabulous partner in crime, about her expertise in dream analysis. And I want to start off by saying, Patricia, that, you know, I'm not a person who usually remembers my dreams, but I had a series of experiences last year where I was somehow astrally traveling in my sleep, and it was getting very tiresome, and I decided to talk to you about it. And you helped me in such an amazing way. I was absolutely able to feel the power that I had to connect to the dream and change it or decide not to go there. Or, you know, I just felt so empowered with the advice that you gave me.
Well,
and I know
thank
you've studied dream analysis for years, that you helped many hundreds of people with charting their dreams, understanding the messages that the dreams are bringing them. And I just wanted to tell everybody that if they're having dream issues, dream concerns, or just curious, that they can find you at supernaturalgirls.com, and there is an ad there for your dream analysis.
Well, thank you. I love doing dream analysis, as you know. It's something I did for many years, and I feel that a lot of people are just leaving their power on the table when it comes to dreams. And it's a great time in our history here on this planet to pick that back up again and really connect. I mean, we've been talking all evening with Guido Massé about connecting with the plants, the herbs, the things that we are so connected to. And the same thing is true with dreams. We need to reconnect with our dreams. So thank you for sharing that with everybody. And, yes, you can find me at supernaturalgirls.com. There is an ad there and my email address. You can just click on it and ask me any questions that you'd like about dream analysis. I'd be happy to answer them for you. And for you, Helene, I have a question because I have two birthday presents. I know a lot of Leos, and they're all having birthdays. So my niece is turning 17, and I wanted to buy her one of the beautiful angelically charged bracelets that you have. Now, I know you've got a lot of them, so I'm going to need your help. And I gave you a quick heads up right before the show that I was going to put you on the spot about this. But you've got the Gateway of Light, the Crown of Jesus bracelet, the Blue Ray of Divinity, the Pathway of Love, and Love Alive. They're all beautiful. Now, what would you recommend for my niece, Rachel?
Well, for your niece, Rachel, what I'm picking up on is that three of those could be good for her. But at 17, no matter how confident you are, no matter how self-assured or mature you seem to be, it's sort of like there's this searching for our own soul. There's the idea of feeling powerful and maintaining our self-esteem in the face of so many pressures. And that's why I think the Crown of Jesus would be best for her. It's a very powerful bracelet, and it will help her feel self-love and self-empowerment.
Well, that's the one I'm going to buy for her. And then I also have my lovely sister-in-law, Melinda. And which one would you recommend for Melinda? And again, I'm asking, just so the audience knows, I'm asking Helene because she is actually going to be tuning in and has tuned in to Rachel. Now she's going to tune in to Melinda because these bracelets are all charged with a certain type of energy. And so I want to make sure that I'm giving these relatives of mine a wonderful gift that is in line with the energy that they need.
Well, I feel like the Gateway of Light vibration would be best because she has varying vibration. I feel a lot of wavering on her part.
Okay.
That she has certain stressors in her life that cause her to sort of waver up and down a lot. And so the Gateway of Light will actually bring a vibration to her system that helps her maintain that balance and see a little bit more clearer on what's going on around her.
I know that what you're saying is true. This would be a big help to her. And for everybody who wants to take a look at these beautiful bracelets, they are at angelslighthouse.com. And if you go to the tab that says shop, you will be taken to a beautiful page where it says Gateway of Light, a unique jewelry collection. And you can purchase everything right online. So I highly recommend these bracelets. I have them myself. I've got two of them, and they are absolutely beautiful, and the energy that radiates from them is truly remarkable. So these are not just pretty little bracelets. They really pack a punch, and they're well worth the investment. So angelslighthouse.com is where to go to find those bracelets.
Well, thank you, Patricia. And I am so enjoying Guido. He has absolutely touched my life. It's just remarkable, and I'm going to run out and buy the book as soon as the show ends because it's just amazing. Just the small amount of tips he was able to fit into tonight's show have just been really life-altering, I think. So,
absolutely. This information is critical, and so let's get back to him because we've still got time, and I want to pack in as much information as we can.
Stay tuned, everyone. And we're back with our fascinating conversation with Guido Maffei, author of the book that everyone must run out and buy, The Wild Medicine Solution. And right now I'm trying really hard to get Guido live back on the air. Oh, here he comes. There you are, Guido.
Hey, phew, there.
Sometimes Blog Talk likes to fool with us, so.
We've got questions in the chat room, and then, of course, I've got a million questions, but we're going to go to the chat room, if you don't mind, for a second, because somebody's asking about calcium, and is there a good herb that people can use? And this is an older woman. She's saying, what about older women and calcium? Is there something that you can give information about?
Yeah, there's a couple of things about calcium. You know, you can take chalk, which is calcium carbonate, and just grind it up and put it in water and try and drink it, you're going to absorb an incredibly small quantity of actually usable calcium from that to help your bones. So really, it's not just the amount of the mineral, but also the form in which you find it that makes a huge difference in terms of how much of it can get into your bones to keep you strong and how much of it can stay in your bloodstream to kind of help with muscle and nerve function. So the plants that we find calcium in don't tend to have, you know, hundreds of milligrams of calcium the way a lot of these calcium pills do, but they're calcium that is in an incredibly bioavailable source that's bound to amino acids, that's very readily absorbable by the body and used to incorporate into healthy bone tissue. So some of the plants that are richest in calcium are the dandelion, again, just straight up. You can use the dandelion root or the dandelion greens. And dandelion greens, although they're a bit of an acquired taste, are extremely, extremely rich in calcium and a really, really nutritive food, okay? And they can be just stewed in soup or eaten whole in salad. It can be cooked like spinach and added to things like kale or collard greens as part of your daily cooking regime. But another plant that is an old traditional food that is loaded with calcium is the stinging nettle, which you may or may not want to grow tons of. If you do, put it in an out-of-the-way corner of your garden because it is definitely stingy. Not like poison ivy, but it can be irritating to the skin for sure in the short term. But people would always and still to this day take nettle and harvest the leaf and cook it down into soups. It's really delicious. It basically tastes like spinach with a little more of a tang, complex flavor to it, loaded with calcium, really good detoxifier of the body through the kidneys, helps for water retention and bloating, but also is really an incredible source of calcium. So I would suggest those two places to start, dandelion leaf, dandelion root, and stinging nettle. also get nettle dried to make into a tea. And the way to brew it into a tea is to steep it overnight. So you'll put about 4 or 5 tablespoons in the bottom of a quart-sized mason jar, pour hot water on it, just like any old cup of tea, let it sit for at least 6 to 8 hours. And in the morning, strain it, add a little bit of honey if you want, or a little bit of maple syrup, and then keep it in the fridge, drink it throughout the day, and that's it.
Wow, that's easy. That sounds great.
Yeah. The long-term extraction is essential to make sure that all of the calcium is leached out of the leaves. It does take a little bit of time. It won't happen in 10 minutes.
Right. Well, that's great. Excellent. Thank you for that wonderful answer for that. And I also see that you talk in your book about chocolate. So we all like chocolate. So let's hear more about that and how good it is for us.
Yeah. Well, there's an example of a plant that isn't local, at least to the Northeast, but I still can't live without, personally. And this is, again, you know, I love the modern world. It lets us have things like chocolate in the middle of the winter in the Northeast. I would not be wanting to give that up. But the research is piling up, both in terms of looking at how the chemistry of chocolate works in the lab, but also in terms of clinical research, where they give chocolate, dark chocolate, to human beings, and they find positive effects, particularly on blood pressure and heart disease. That seems to be the place, the heart and the blood vessels, where chocolate really shines. Now, all of us who are into chocolate know that you can get this sort of euphoriant effect from it, too. And it's got these chemical compounds that have this somewhat relaxing and joy-enhancing effect on the brain. And also, in its raw form, it's quite bitter. So it has a little bit of that effect, too. Now, when we're talking about chocolate to be used as medicine, we really have to think about dark chocolate, 70%, ideally even higher than that, like 80% dark chocolate or cacao. And at these concentrations, it's extremely healthful, extremely nutritious food. It's loaded with protein. It's loaded with good quality fat. It has very little sugar and piles of these polyphenolic compounds that regulate the level of inflammation in our cardiovascular system and can help reduce blood pressure. So chocolate gets at that number one killer of men and of women after menopause in this country, which is heart disease. Huge problem. And again, I think the reason heart disease is such a big problem is because we're missing things like berry anthocyanidins, hawthorn berries, blueberries, and the same kind of compounds that you see in chocolate from our diet. People don't eat a lot of this stuff anymore. Now, I really fell in love with chocolate. I've obviously been into it since I can remember, as most children and people are who taste the stuff. But we went down to Guatemala, and I was able to kind of watch the whole process happening, from the fermentation of these cacao pods to remove the bean, ferment it to get that fruity flavor, and then roast it to get that darkness that we're so familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever been down to Central America, I really feel, you know, we did a lot of visiting of Mayan ruins at the same time. We would get down into the bottoms of these pyramids in these little tiny passages that people had carved out, and they'd open into this chamber where there was this sort of jade sarcophagus that the princess of the Mayan kingdom, you know, over 1,500 years ago, had been buried in. Oh, my goodness. I really feel it's the power place of this continent. This magic and this spirit flows from these jungles of Central America down the Andes and up through Mexico and the American Southwest and the Rockies, and just, you know, feeds the power that the native people have in this on this continent. I really believe it, and it's so tangible when you're down there. And I think chocolate is sort of their archetypal power drink, right? So it has this dark medicine and magic to it that I think really is essential for this culture, and the way it really shines and the way we see it used clinically is for cardiovascular disease. So I usually recommend to guys who walk into my office or concerned about high blood pressure, to women pre- and post-menopause, if there's any kind of family history or concern with high blood pressure or atherosclerosis, you know, those plaques that form inside the vessels, you know, I tell them you got to get your 80% dark chocolate bar, and you got to eat a third to half of it every day.
Wow.
And they look at me like I'm crazy, you know. And I tell them that you should also have a frozen blueberry smoothie along with that. And then they continue to look at me like I'm crazy. But really, this is the kind of medicine we're talking about. It's medicine that comes from plants and that is delicious most of the time, especially when you prepare it right. And the blueberry chocolate combination is excellent for blood vessel health, for preventing heart disease. And it's something that can even be used safely by diabetics, where heart disease is one of the major, major complications of diabetes. Small vessel disease in the kidneys and in the eyes. Chocolate, when it's 70 or 80% dark, extremely easy to do. Another great way to do it is to take an organic cacao powder. I often will recommend green and black organic cacao powder. You take 2 tablespoons of that. You put about a tablespoon of honey with it, some hot water, and if you want, a little bit of Damiana tincture, if you can get a hold of it. Damiana is this great sort of spicy aphrodisiac plant. Mix it all together, you make a medicinal hot chocolate. Have one of those every day, your blood vessels and your heart will thank you.
Wow. And that sounds absolutely delicious. It really is making me hungry.
It's very good, but the side effect is it might spice up your love life a little bit.
Are these recipes in your book, Guido?
Yes, they are.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, we have a caller. And we're going to welcome Eddie from one of the Carolinas on the line, live on the air. Eddie, how are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Greetings. How's everybody?
We're great.
Doing well, Eddie. Good. Greetings to you.
Hey, Guido. It's good to hear you. I wanted to ask, you mentioned to the lady who put some information in the chat room, about chalk. Is that Indian chalk you're speaking of, or is that like any kind of commercial? You know, what kind of chalk do you mean?
I just mean, you know, the chalk that you use to write on a chalkboard with, which is calcium carbonate. I don't know specifically about Indian chalk and whether it's more available to the system or not. But generally, you know, like limestone or chalk, it's very difficult to get it to dissolve in water, so it's difficult to absorb it into the body. And a lot of the sort of lower-end calcium supplements that you might find at the pharmacy are just that. They're just calcium carbonate. So it doesn't really matter if there's 500 milligrams of calcium carbonate in that pill. You're going to get very little of it actually into your bloodstream.
Mm. Okay, awesome. Now, the mention of the cacao.
Yeah.
Have you heard of the Jamaican cocoa balls? Is that similar or the same thing? Are you familiar with it?
No. Why don't you tell me the recipe? I'd love to hear.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know exactly where it comes from, but they have this this ball. It looks basically like chalk, except, of course, it's brown. And they make something called cocoa tea with it. You know, they say it's good for your blood plasma and things of that nature. You know, but it's from the Caribbean, you know, at least that's, you know, where I was introduced to it from, you know, some friends of mine from the Caribbean. And I'm wondering, yes?
That sounds great, you know, as long as there's not a ton of sugar in it and fat from milk, you know, like a milk chocolate would have, it doesn't sound like it, you know, it sounds like they're just got a pretty, you know, a massive cacao and they're adding hot water to it, which makes great sense to me. As long as it kind of tastes sweet, only a little, but bitter and fruity as well, and you get the real cacao flavor, I would say it's, without a doubt, pretty medicinal stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely bitter. It's not, there's not too much sweetness to it. They definitely, just like you were mentioning, they add honey and a little bit of cinnamon and, you know, nutmeg, of course. They put nutmeg in a lot of their stuff, even their carrot juices and things of that nature.
Yeah.
In your book, do you have some recipes for the blender? You know, like if you don't want to heat or cook your vegetables and things of that nature, you have some recipes for using a blender?
Yeah, I have. Basically, I use the smoothie as a canvas, you know. So you can do so much with a blender. And, you know, if you have some apple juice and some bananas and frozen blueberries, stuff like that. So I definitely bring that out a couple times, especially for some of the plants that are a little sort of harder to take whole.
Okay, and if I may ask one more question. I know that here in North America there's quite a few herbs that we tend to go to health food stores and whatnot to purchase. Do you have picture illustrations in your book so that, you know, some of the things that grow locally, we could basically, you know, utilize?
I have pictures, but my pictures that I put in the book for all the plants that I talk about, they're more sort of, I try to get at the spirit and the personality of the plant with my picture, so it's a little less for identification and a little more for getting in touch with, you know, what we were talking about earlier, the fact that these plants have spirits and personalities to them. I recommend a good ID book like A Peterson's Guide to Eastern Medicinal Plants, or getting, you know, just a regular ID book for foraging, like a regular wildflower identification book. I think you'll do a lot better in terms of going out there. And if you can find, you know, someone who knows the woods or the fields and walk with them a couple times, there's nothing like a person actually pointing a plant out to you. You can't get that from a book, if you know what I mean.
I definitely do. My grandma used to tell me that, you know, she had communication, you know, like plants talked to her, even though, you know, she passed when I was much, much younger. So it's really unfortunate that, you know, I didn't grasp that information from her. You know, I mean, even though herbs aren't that expensive in a health food store, but it's just to have that, you know, connection in this day and time, it would definitely be, you know.
Well, Eddie, it's never too late to start. And I will tell you, I think it's the human being's birthright to be able to talk to plants. It's something you can learn and do really easily, and you just got to get out there and do it. The plants want you, and they want to talk to you. I really am a firm believer in that, and I've seen it time and time again with my students. I get folks who have no experience in herbal medicine who start, you know, the training process. And after a few weeks, they're coming and telling me stuff that I'm, you know, wow, I 10 years of studying plants, and I'm barely starting to get a handle on that. And they say, well, I was sitting with the lavender bee balm, and she told me that. So anyway, plants are great equalizers, and you don't have to be some kind of super-trained master to be able to get some amazing messages from them, in my opinion.
Great, great. I definitely appreciate you. How about the sugars? Didn't you mention something about certain sugars that the body needs? That'll be my last question, I promise.
Yeah, they're not actually sugars in that they don't have caloric value. We can break them down, but they're chains of sugar, kind of like, you know, there's certain starches that we can get energy from, but there are other starches like cellulose that we can't. You know, we can't break down bark from a tree, for instance. But these starch chains in things like reishi mushroom pass through our system, and they don't really get completely digested, but they talk to our immune system, which the lymphatic system through which immune cells kind of swim has patches throughout the gut that stick up and out and kind of sample the contents of what we've eaten. And when they encounter these sugar chains, these polysaccharides, that aren't sweet, really, and don't have really any caloric quality to them, they it sort of wakes them up, kind of the way the bitters wake up the digestive process and the aromatic plants kind of wake up the nervous system. So that's really what I was talking about. It's not a sugar like, you know, something like table sugar or honey. Sugar-based chains of, they're called polysaccharides and proteoglycans.
Yes, exactly. I understood that. I just wanted to ask that question because at one time, there was a company, I think the FDA so-called took them off the market, and that's basically what their product was. I don't remember the name of the company, unfortunately, but the sugars is basically the term they used, that your body needs, but your body doesn't exactly manufacture. It's not like table sugar and things like that. We know that's commercial, and there's, you know, really no benefit
right
to it besides the sweet taste. You know, it's like you say, honey and agave and things of that nature is more acceptable and usable in a human body. But these sugars, I can't remember the name of this company, but they did have a product called Trehalose or something like that. You know, it was very, very good. My mom, she passed the cancer, and at one time, you know, she was taking it. Unfortunately, she stopped. But those products like that, just like you're saying, really help the body, you know, eradicate disease, and, you know, different inflammations that, you know, come with our improper diets and the thought process also. I really appreciate you, Guido. And
Oh, nothing. I was just going to say my suggestion would be to go out into the woods and sit with the reishi mushroom and get that experience, you know, and then get the medicine from it. I think it's so important to be out there with it if you at all can, because that changes you too. That heals you too. You know, going out to the forest and finding that fan of Reishi growing out of a hemlock tree is an amazingly powerful experience. And then you bring it home and you commune with it internally, if you at all can. You know, but then finding someone who can and hook you up with it, that's second best and still quite excellent too. But I appreciate your call. Thanks, Eddie.
Thanks. Thank you, ladies, and I hope you have
this
book
you
on
so
your
much,
website.
Eddie.
And
yeah, thanks, Eddie. Those are great questions. Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
All right. Y'all stay blessed. I'll keep listening.
Thank you. You too. Many blessings to you.
Well, it's really wonderful to get such amazing calls and questions from people. And honestly, Guido, you have absolutely touched my life just with the few tips that you were able to give tonight. And, you know, the most important thing I think that you've said so far is, besides your vast knowledge and amazing education and all of your experience, is the idea that any person can connect with nature and can connect with plants and can actually feel healing just by being in that vibration. And I think that's where it all begins, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And herbal medicine is a little different than pharmaceutical medicine, right? Herbs aren't just substitutes for pills. They're kind of this process that gets into you a little bit, and it brings you back out into the garden, or even if it's only out into, you know, an abandoned lot in the city, it gets you noticing stuff that is otherwise hidden. And then you start thinking about processes that are hidden, and you can call them spirits, you can call them vibrations, or you can pursue a PhD in systems theory if you'd rather do it that way. But there's wisdom in all of those approaches, and the traditional culture and the herbal culture definitely values all of them. And no one is sort of beneath herbal knowledge. No one is sort of beneath the dandelion. It wants to be with all of us, and anyone can connect with it in really powerful ways, you know, right away, as long as we're willing to just sit down with it.
Well, Patricia, I know
yes,
you
ma'am.
Have many, many, many burning questions, so
I
pick
still,
one
I
more.
I still do. I mean, I could talk to Guido all night. I mean, there's just so much that I want to know. And, Guido, you're such an incredible wealth of information on all of this. And what I really love about what you're doing and sharing with your fabulous book, The Wild Medicine Solution, and all of your classes, your students you're teaching, is what I like about it is you're giving people back their own connection to themselves, their own health, and their own personal power in this. I mean, I really hate to see people just giving away their power to a medical system and say, fix me. That's not how it works. So I just feel so excited about what you're sharing because it's saying you can take this back. And again, this is not to say don't ever go to a doctor or hospital or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But there is a place where we all need to reconnect with our power in being able to manage our own health, make better lifestyle choices, and make these deeper connections. And this is what you're offering through your classes and your book, The Wild Medicine Solution. It's great. It's been a pleasure having you on the show this evening. You've been a great guest.
Thanks. It was a pleasure for me, too, and I couldn't have said it better myself.
That's great. Well, we are psychics, so we do read your mind. So.
I guess so.
So much fun. So
we're going to have you back because I know we're going to have people that are going to say, I missed the show, and I didn't get to ask my questions, so we're going to have to invite you back. Guido, this has been great.
I would love that, and you know, we can come up with some special recipes for our listeners, or you know, anything in the field of herbal medicine. We kind of spoke generally tonight, and I love talking about that. But we could also get a little more specific on any topic that you'd be more interested in. I again really appreciate both of you and the work that you do in helping people see that which isn't necessarily in front of everybody's eyes. And I think it's important to do that from time to time. And nature is a huge source of that for me personally. And I think there's a lot of sort of unseen wisdom and beauty and power that's there. And as you said, is a great source of empowerment for people. And I think it's our responsibility to get out there and do that. And the plants want us to do that. And they're there sitting on the trail and sitting in, you know, the unwanted places of the garden and kind of lifting up their flags and saying, hey, remember me. I know I'm not the big juicy tomato, but boy, am I important for your life. I'm trying to connect you back to this ecology through the source of life for you. So thanks for the opportunity.
Wonderful. Thank you. And I just want to let you know that the chat room people are writing in and saying, he's terrific. Please have him back. And another book has been sold. So these are the messages coming through from our wonderful chat room. And, again, thank you, all our listeners. We have the best listeners, the best audience. They're really a great group. They always ask intelligent questions and have terrific comments. And we thank every one of them for tuning in tonight and every week.
Yeah, and we'd also like to thank our fabulous screener, Jim, this evening. And thank you for doing a great job, Jim. And,
thank you, Jim.
Awesome that he's so available to donate his time to us, and we appreciate it. Thank you, Guido. We appreciated your time, which is very valuable. We appreciate your huge message in connecting with as many people as you possibly can. So we will be talking to you soon.
Yes. Many blessings. Thank you.
You're welcome. Blessings to you, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night, Guido. What a show. Wow.
I mean, we have some of the most
fabulous. You know what it was, though?
It
wasn't just Guido's knowledge. It was his whole essence.
Absolutely.
Because his message and his mission is really planetary. I mean, I know he's trying to help the American culture because we're all sort of, on some level, addicted to all this stuff that's been put in front of us. But he really gets to the heart of the matter and is able to really connect any person who wants to just listen.
Well, I know, and that's what I love, too, is that everybody can have this kind of connection. And it is something that, again, he can teach people. And as he's saying, his students are also teaching him. Now, how wonderful is that?
Well, that's a true teacher, right? Teacher
exactly.
is always a student. Yep.
That's a master.
Well, it is. And he is a master. And this has been just an awesome, awesome show. Well, and we've come to the end again, and it went by so quickly, Patricia.
Much too quickly, but so enjoyable.
It was. I hope everyone runs on over to supernaturalgirlswithaz.com and signs up for our fabulous weekly newsletter, and that automatically enters you to win prizes in the very near future. I think we have some books to give away.
We have books that we're going to be giving away, and readings and dream analysis and all kinds of things, so you have an opportunity to win any number of things by signing up.
Mm-hmm. Well, good night, Patricia.
Well, good night, Helene, and good night to our fabulous audience. We will be talking to you next week. We're going to have Tom Waters on, and he's going to be talking about alchemy, and the products that are being made today are going to blow your mind. So tune in next week, and have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your evening, everybody.